Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Luke's English Podcast is sponsored by iTalki, the online platform for improving your spoken fluency by having conversations and lessons with qualified English speakers from the comfort of your own home. I'm proud to have iTalki as my sponsor because I really believe it's a good service and because doing regular speaking practice is perhaps the best way to make rapid progress in your English. So I think it's perfect for listeners to my podcast because you already get plenty of listening practice here with the podcast, but you might really need to activate your English by speaking it. Visit teacherluke.co.uk/talk to get started, to check it out, or click an iTalki logo on my website. Oh, and by the way, iTalki would like to offer you a free lesson when you make a purchase just because you're a Lepster. teacherluke.co.uk/talk to get started, or click an iTalki logo on my website. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, everyone. This is Luke's English Podcast, episode number 608, and it's called The Mass Observation with Mum. The Mass Observation. What's that all about, you might be thinking? This sounds like some kind of Big Brother thing. Like maybe the government observing everyone in some kind of dystopian future, and somehow my mum is involved in it. Well, I'm afraid it's far less dramatic than that. In fact, the mass observation in the title is a social history project that's been going on in the UK probably for 70 years or more. It's a project that my mum has fairly recently got involved in. Basically, the mass observation, which is now administered by the University of Sussex, aims to record everyday life in Britain through a panel of volunteer observers who either keep diaries or reply to open-ended questionnaires known as directives. My mum is one of those volunteers, and since this project is all about collecting information on everyday life in the UK, we thought it might be an interesting episode of Luke's English Podcast. So that's what you're going to get here, a conversation with my mum on a variety of topics which have come up in the quarterly questionnaires from the mass observation. So you can expect some rambling conversation between the two of us on things like this. Protests. That's when people go in the street, probably with signs. They're annoyed. They're demonstrating against something. They're protesting against something. So protests in the street. Plastic. Well, we all know what that is and how ubiquitous it is. It's everywhere. Plastic. So we talk about that. Identity and gender identity. Sex education in school. Loneliness and belonging. And milk as well. I know, like identity and gender identity, sex education, loneliness and belonging, and milk. Yep, those are all things that have come up in the mass observation in the last year or two while my mum's been doing it. So those are things we talk about. There's also some chat at the start about Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, following on from the last time my mum was on the podcast when we talked about the royal wedding. Obviously, since then, Harry and Meghan have had a baby and all that stuff, so we talk about that a little bit. So now you can enjoy about an hour's worth of my mum's nice voice and accent talking about a variety of issues relating to everyday life in the UK. I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back to talk a little bit more on the other side of the conversation. In terms of language learning, your task, as ever, is just to keep on listening. At the very least, that's all you have to do here. Just listen. Follow the conversation, see what you can learn from it, and try to notice any features of English or vocabulary along the way. But the main thing is, just enjoy this chat between my mum and me, which is going to start right now. Are you really going to go,
Yeah, probably.
Okay, well, I'll be prepared for that.
Good.
You are in channel number one.
Could you just talk a little bit? Let's see.
Yes, I'll talk a little bit. I've got the microphone up to my mouth. That's correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Do I need to keep talking?
Yes. You will do, yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I had boiled egg for my breakfast and some toast and some melon. And for my lunch, I had a salad made for me by my brother. Is that enough?
I don't know. Was it enough?
Is that enough talking
I mean. I've got a good sound level good. For you now.
Right.
So, hello, Mum. How are you?
Hello, Luke. I'm fine. Bit tired, but you're making me sit down and record this thing.
Am I really making you doing
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you're forcing me. You've got my hand behind my back.
I'm twisting your arm.
You are.
Well, okay, listeners.
But I'll do my best.
So I've twisted my mum's arm, forced her to appear on the podcast. Is it really like, you know, is that what it takes to get you on my podcast? I have to force you to do it?
Yeah.
Why? Why? Why the struggle?
Well, it's not a struggle. If it was sort of 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it would be fine.
Yeah, but it wouldn't, though, would it?
It's nearly 10:45 at night, and it's past my bedtime.
Oh, God. So the last time this happened was with James.
Really?
Did you hear that episode where we recorded it right here? I was sitting in this spot, and he was sitting where you were.
Well, I can understand where James was coming from.
So can I.
Good.
Okay, well, now my listeners feel like a human rights violation is occurring on the podcast, that I'm forcing you.
Well, this is what you do, Luke.
What?
Isn't it? Let's face it. It's what you do with all your members of your family. You force them in the late night to sit down and do podcasts.
Are you serious?
Totally. Why wouldn't I be?
This is British humour, isn't it?
Mm.
Like,
carry on.
Can never tell
on.
If
keep
people
going.
Are being serious. I think that sort of, I could take that on face value, actually, as being a sort of, I don't know.
Right.
So it's been ages since you were last on this podcast.
Really? What was the last one?
Do you not remember?
No.
We talked about the royal wedding.
Oh, yes. Gosh. Yeah. They've had a baby since then.
Yeah, we're talking about Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. We talked together about their wedding. How do you reckon it's going for them now then? How long has it been? A couple of years?
I don't know.
They've got a child now.
They've got a baby, so it's got to be at least... And the baby must be, 3 months old now? So it's got to be a year.
I think it's a year, actually. I think it was a year in sort of May or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it seems to be going all right, apart from the fact that the British press seems to have decided to take against her and be nasty to her.
How? In what ways? Well, what kinds of stuff? I mean, they're just printing lots of... You're talking about...
They are making out that Meghan and Kate don't get on and are fighting, and that Meghan is a bit of a diva. And she got into trouble with some people because she edited Vogue recently, which apparently is not... Some people thought royal people shouldn't do.
Sarah Vine in the Daily Mail?
I
mean,
I'm
sorry to bring up her name. She's married to Michael Gove.
Yes.
I talked to Dad about Michael Gove on the podcast recently as well. But Sarah Vine is
a very nice couple, Sarah Vine and British, Michael Gove. I think we'll have them around for dinner.
There's more of that British humour, folks.
I'm sure we'd get on with them really well.
See the deep level of sarcasm? So, Sarah Vine is a columnist or writer for the Daily Mail.
Columnist, I think, of the Daily Mail.
Daily Mail newspaper. And one of the things that she wrote in the paper, and she keeps writing things about Meghan Markle.
She's nasty. She's a nasty piece of work.
Yeah.
She can't say anything nice about anybody.
No, she
and
can't.
She's particularly got it in for Meghan.
That's her business, isn't it? It's just to be a bit conniving.
Just to be nasty.
And nasty. And she keeps saying nasty things about Meghan Markle and sort of... Yeah, you kind of wonder, what's your problem with Meghan Markle then,
exactly. Why do you have to be so nasty about people all the time?
Yeah. So despite the fact that she's having a hard time from certain members of the press in the UK, they've had a little baby. What's his name?
Archie.
Archie Harrison something, isn't it?
Archie Harrison, can't remember.
Right, Google it. Come on.
Mountbatten.
Now... Listeners, at least one person is their brain is exploding right now because you're British and you don't know the name of every single member of the family, including the most recent baby. Yeah, it's true. I'm going to actually Google this Archie and see when the See when it actually tells
comes
me.
Up,
Archie
yeah.
Harrison. Mm. Archie Harrison, Mountbatten,
yeah.
Windsor. Okay.
Yeah.
The Mountbatten, Windsor stuff. I mean, these are just like, you know, technical
family
names and stuff. Archie. What do you think of that as a first name?
I think it's fine. It's very fashionable at the moment.
Yeah. Is it short for another name? Is it
Archibald?
Is it Archibald? I think actually for them it's not. They've written Archie.
Yeah. Lots of people now call their kids Archie.
What do you make of Harrison? Do you know what that is? Do you know what that is?
What do you mean?
It's actually a joke. It's a pun.
Harry's son.
Genuinely.
Really?
They've put a pun in his name.
How do you know that? You know that's for... You've heard it from his mouth, have you?
What? Archie's mouth?
Harry's mouth.
Can't speak yet. all right, I'm Googling Archie Harrison, why Harrison? Oh, goodness.
Well, it'll be speculation. Nobody knows for sure.
I'm sure I heard it somewhere that someone... Oh, dear.
Maybe they're just fans of Harrison Ford.
You reckon? Like, no one's that much of a fan of Harrison Ford. I mean, he's all right in Indiana Jones, but he's...
Anyway, why are we wasting time on this?
I need
to get to bed, Luke.
Oh God, is that going to be the tone of this conversation? it is, isn't it, listeners?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, it's great for everyone listening to know that you're...
So keen.
Fully committed to this. I can see where James gets it from.
Don't know what you mean.
Feel free to just lie down at any point and close your eyes. That's what he did.
He can do that, but I can't.
Anyway, so...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we've been struggling to think of things for you to talk about on this podcast, because I could just ramble on with you for hours and hours, about anything and everything.
Mm, probably.
But what we were to... Like, you mentioned to me the other day that you've been doing this thing that I didn't know you were doing, that you've been taking part in some sort of mass national survey, right? What's it called? The Mass Observation.
It's called the Mass Observation.
The Mass Observation. So you've been taking part in this thing called the Mass Observation, and I think Dad was the one who said, oh, you should talk about that on the podcast. It could be interesting.
Mm.
So let's do that then, shall we? Let's talk about the Mass Observation on the podcast and what it is and what it involves, and then we can kind of take it from there.
Okay.
And we'll talk about it for 9 hours. Okay. And
no way.
I'm going to be propping up your eyelids with matchsticks. So what is the Mass Observation then? Sounds a bit sort of scary. It's like you go into
Big
a room.
Brother.
Yeah, it's like loads of people just watching other people or something. But what is
it? No, it's not that. It's Well, I first was aware of it because it was a big thing in the war, in wartime in Britain. I think it was started originally in the late 1930s as a way of finding out what ordinary people feel about things. And they asked certain people to write diaries, I think, about various bits of their life. And... I'm very vague about the beginning of it, but during the war they did it a lot, and they had lots of ordinary people recording their experiences, for example, in the London Blitz, or, you know, people who were working on the land, or just information from ordinary people instead of it being all information from the people in charge.
Because, like...
It was social. It's social history as opposed to... history of rulers and
like
things.
Political history or something. Because when we look back into history, it's true, isn't it, that we always go to the kings and queens of England.
We always learn about kings, queens, presidents, prime ministers, all those kinds of things.
And that's our window into the world. I mean, there are other things that can tell us about the lives of ordinary people. Like, for example, you've got something like Samuel Pepys's diary
Yes, except he wasn't entirely an ordinary person. He was obviously a person of certain rank. But I think it's very interesting to try and find out about what we all want to know is what ordinary people's lives are like.
Mm.
And it's much more interesting to find out about certain periods in time if you can access in some way what it was like to be an ordinary person, mm-hmm. and how all these things that were happening on high by, you know, the rules that were passed, or the troubles that the princes were having or the kings were having or whatever, how that affected ordinary people in their ordinary lives.
Yeah.
And this is a way of recording people's ordinary lives so that in the future, when people want to do research, they've got this vast...
database
archive of people's experiences.
I see.
And now it's much more organized in that they sign people up like me to answer various things. They send out what they call a directive every 3 months where they ask you certain questions about things that are going on in the world or in the country. And just ask you to write how you feel about it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they just keep it in the archives for people to use for various bits of research.
So the project or the group, the organisation responsible for administering the mass observation, you're getting hot. You're having a hot flush.
Can I open the window? Yes, go on.
You say they... You mean those responsible for administering the mass observation, right?
So. These days, it's run by University of, is it Sussex or somewhere in, yes, it's the University of Sussex, I'm sure,
okay.
in Bristol. So that's and they're the ones that keep the all the archives and so on.
I see. So essentially, it's a project to create...
Yes, it's in Brighton.
A popular history... from the lives of ordinary people so that in the future it'll be easy to access information about what life was really like for normal people.
Yeah.
And this has been going on since...
Since the 1930s.
Since the late
30s. I think it's changed. I think they did it for a while in the 30s and then they stopped. And then it started again in the war, I think. And since 1982, I think, they started doing it again... in a very organised way.
Okay. How long have you been doing it?
Not long, only about a year.
Okay.
So I've done one round of directives.
So you've done four?
I've done four.
Four directives.
I think so, yeah.
Could you tell us what those directives have been?
I can try and remember the first one. Oh, gosh, what was the first one? I can't remember. It was about... Oh, yes, it was a weird one. It was about protests. I think maybe we'd been having a lot of protests about various things, mainly Brexit. And they were asking, for example, they say, we are interested in your thoughts, opinions and experiences of protests. So first of all, you have to write down the first five words you think of when you think of protest. And then you have to remember what were the first memories you have of any kind of protest. And then they ask you, you know, have you ever been on one yourself? And what do you think about them? And, you know, all that sort of thing.
Before we get stuck into protests then, I just want to know, how did you end up doing this? Did they approach you or did you sign up? Did you go, oh, I quite like that as an idea. I think I'll support it by offering up my personal history.
I've just always been interested in it. And I read a book by Simon Garfield, who's a very prolific writer. And he tends to use a lot of archive material for his books. And he wrote a book about people's lives during the war, you know, ordinary people's lives at home, not soldiers in the war, but the people left at home in London, involved in the Blitz, or people working on farms, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it was called, but it was very interesting. I found it much more interesting to read about that than reading about soldiers in the war or airmen or all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's... Oh, and also... Victoria Wood was also interested in it. She wrote a play called Housewife 49, based on someone called Nella Last, who was a correspondent that they had, who used to send in letters, diaries and things. And her life, and it's very interesting, not just about the war and her part in it at home. You know, she became a member of the WRVS, the Women's Royal Voluntary society, who used to help people who'd been bombed out, you know, by giving them clothes and places to live and all that sort of thing.
This is the woman that Victoria Wood wrote a play about.
This is Housewife number 49, right. Nella Last.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was interesting in itself. And, yeah, so that's just one individual person who's done it.
Yeah.
But that gives you an idea of the sort of thing you can find out.
But yeah, Simon, what was his name?
Simon Garfield.
Simon Garfield, Victoria Wood, two people sort of in your orbit in terms of, you know, like people...
People who I read or...
People you read or people you respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you sort
so
of
So I
thought,
was interested in it from that.
Mass observation seems interesting.
Yes.
You thought to yourself...
And I thought, I wonder if they still do it. So I think I Googled it and I came up with this University of Sussex site where they told me all about it. And it said, you know, we're happy to take on people if you want to apply. So I did. And they wrote me a letter and said, yes, we'll have you. Please start sending us. Oh, no, they said, send us some information about yourself. You have to be careful because you can't identify other people.
Huh?
Because, you know, there's a privacy thing. You know, you could start talking about... Mrs. Brown at number five, you know, she does this and that and the other.
So you can. I'm just imagining, what are they afraid of? Like in the mass observation, yes, we'd like to know about, you know, your experiences with shopkeepers. Like, well, Mr. Smith in the grocer's store is a right piece of work, let me tell you.
Yeah.
No, we're not looking for that sort of information, actually. Mm. So, yeah, they don't need, they don't want to know.
Well, I think they probably became very aware of it or cautious of it during the war because you could have people saying, you know, that Mrs. Brown down the road, well, she consorts with American soldiers or, you know, she sends messages off to Germany and Japan, you know, telling us what's going on.
Right.
There's, you know, you have to be careful during wartime. So I think during the war they said you've got to be very circumspect. You can't... mention people. You can only talk about yourself. And if you talk about other people, you just have to say they are your friend or your son or your... I won't tell you what I've told them about you, Luke.
Oh, yeah, really?
and you mustn't name names. You have to be a little bit careful.
You can't say my son. What do you... You know, tell us about protests. Well... Well, I'd like to protest about the way my son forces me to podcast in the middle of the night. Mm. Okay.
Yes.
So, protests then was the first one.
That was the first one.
Ooh. So, what did you tell them about protests then? Can you, I mean, you can just tell us.
I think
you?
So, yeah. I don't see why not. I mean, I just told them that my first, I mean, I'm hopeless really on the subject. The first protest I'm aware of.
Yeah.
I can remember was the one on Grosvenor Square in 1968 against the Vietnam War. And I remember it because it was on the television news and there was a grey police horse involved in this protest. And it just shows how useless I was, how trivial I was in those days. I didn't think about the protest or the people on the protest or what they were protesting about. I was worried about this poor horse and whether it was going to be injured by the protesters. So
we're talking probably 1968, a protest.
I think it was 1968.
Against, it would have been.
It was the Vietnam War.
Protest against the Vietnam War in, where was it,
Grosvenor Square, Grosvenor Square which is in where the American embassy was.
In London.
Yeah.
I used to teach a student in Grosvenor Square. So it's a very posh part of London, isn't it? It's a Mayfair.
Mm.
So anyway, so there was a protest there.
That's the one I remember first.
Against the Vietnam War, 1968. And can I ask you how old you were at the time? You would have been about 19.
68, I was 19.
19
I think,
years old around that
something
time,
like
yeah.
That.
So you saw the reports of it on telly and you're like, oh, that horse. I hope that
poor horse.
I hope that horse is okay.
I didn't think, oh, those people are wonderful protesting about the Vietnam War. I just worried about the horse.
So you wrote that, did you? I said, in 1968, I was worried about a horse.
Yeah.
What, do you know what happened to that horse, Mum?
No.
Oh,
do you?
No, I don't. Okay, so that was your first experience with a protest.
That was my first experience of a protest.
Have you ever been on a protest?
No.
Really? I thought you had. I thought you'd been on a... I thought you must have demonstrated against something, no?
No.
You're just very English. Just go home and have a cup of tea.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the English
approach. Say jolly good to all those people who do.
Or just if there's something really that you really disagree with strongly... You'll just keep it to yourself and just go and have a cup of tea. And in France, they'll take to the streets.
Well, I know.
They love protesting in France.
I know.
It's almost like they'll. It's like, oh, we haven't had a protest in a while. Quick, you know, get the yellow jackets on. Let's get out and smash a few taxis up. What are we protesting about? Because we haven't had a protest for ages. But you take the more English approach. Do you, you haven't protested? Because I know you feel strongly about social issues.
Well, I did think recently I've thought about going on protests about Brexit.
Steady on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just makes me sound really pathetic, partly because I'm lazy and it would mean I'd have to go down on the train to London because that's where they all are. I'd have to get, you know, make myself go do that. And then when I got there, there'd be hundreds, thousands of people. And I don't like being in crowds. Crowds worry me.
Yeah, you're like that horse, basically, aren't you, in Grosvenor Square?
The horse was braver than I would be in the middle of loads of crowds. Yeah.
Maybe we should get you a horse so you can...
So I'm just useless, really.
Well, you're not, useless.
I do approve of lots of people protesting.
Yeah. I mean, the question of whether it makes a
difference... Whether it does anything. I mean, the protests we've had over Brexit, millions of people protested. And what notice has been taken? None.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's skirt round that particular subject.
Yeah, we won't talk about that.
We'll sidestep that one.
It's too distressing.
Yeah, I mean...
Protests,
then, was the first thing.
And I wrote about my experience, which was nothing. and they also talked about what did I think about the policing of protests.
Yeah.
Because that's been quite a controversial thing recently. Well, it was a few years ago because the police used to do this kettling.
Yeah, they called it kettling.
Procedure.
So when there were protesters in the street, usually in London, I think, the police had a certain method of dealing with it, which is basically they would, using police horses, they would surround the protesters.
They would corral them.
Break them up, surround them with horses, and then sort of squish them all in together.
And just keep them...
Keep them all in.
Corralled.
Very close.
Hours sometimes.
Yeah, just squish them all into very... Pack the protesters into a small space surrounded by horses. A very intimidating, a very uncomfortable way. So basically sort of smothering the process. And it's... I think it can be very horrible to
intimidating,
be...
Intimidating, claustrophobic.
Claustrophobic to be squashed in there with all those people. And it really takes the...
And what happens if you need to go to the loo?
Well, that, you know, you just... That's, you know... That's part of it, isn't it? That you
that's one thing. I mean, I need to be within reach of a loo all the time.
Well, that's part of the what the police are doing, isn't it?
That's part of the intimidation.
Yeah, that it's so uncomfortable. I mean, obviously, in some places, they'll just break your legs, but they'll probably do that in England as well. In France, they have a slightly more hands-off approach. Do you know about that?
No.
The police generally sort of stay away from the protesters and just fire... tear gas at them. And so whenever there are protests on the streets of Paris, which, as we've said, is quite a lot.
Very frequently.
Especially more recently with the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow coats, the yellow jacket protesters. Lots of tear gas gets fired around. And I've had students coming into classes before who've literally been tear gassed that day.
Dear.
And they come in and they're like, sorry, horrible. I'm late. I just got tear gassed.
Incredible.
Like, wow. Okay. Well, there you go. That's protest.
So that was protest.
Done. What was the second one then that they asked you about?
I can't remember. I have to look in my file.
Mum is now shuffling through some notes. Pages of photocopied
you
stuff
have allowed me to.
Well, you can.
Oh, when was that?
Plastics.
There was one on plastics. Yeah, that was the last one I did. That was the spring one.
Plastics.
Asking all about plastics. What sort of plastics do we use? You know, things like are they useful? Could you live without them? Can you think of ways you could do without
them? Well, those are some decent questions.
Do you remember what it was like before plastics? What were things made of before then? Do you think it's possible to live without them future? That kind of thing.
These are all very good questions.
They are.
So do you use a lot of plastic?
Yeah, of course. Everybody does.
Mm. It's a pity, isn't it?
And it's very hard to see how you could not live without them. You know, you can think about, you know, not buying plastic shopping bags. Well, we don't do that. I haven't done that for years.
What do you use instead?
I use the wickerwork ones that I bought in the market in France many years ago, which are baskets, you know, old-fashioned baskets.
Weaved baskets, yeah. Weaved from wicker.
All my shopping bags come from France.
Well,
ones we bought in Serres, the wickerwork ones, and recently the ones we got in
Carrefour in
Paris.
Carrefour supermarket.
Yeah, which are made of material, just cotton.
Fabric.
Which is brilliant.
Yeah, they're very good, aren't they?
It's the best kind of thing. Because, you know, here, for years, we've had what they call the...
A bag for life.
A bag for life, which is made of plastic.
Oh, a bag for life is made from plastic,
is it? Yeah, of course it is.
The idea is it's basically a thicker, more durable plastic bag.
That you use for a long time.
You're supposed to reuse, but, I mean, even that is made of plastic. Yeah.
So I've got rid of all those. I never use those now. Well, I've still got them, but I don't use them for shopping, and I haven't bought one for a long time.
But basically, when you go down to the supermarket or to the shops or something, you just bring one of these fabric bags.
Fabric and wickerwork baskets.
Okay.
And
all right.
That kind of thing.
Well, that's a step in
so
the
that's
right.
easy enough. But things like, you know, shampoo bottles...
Yeah.
Shower gel, cosmetics, you know, plastic packaging.
It's a big one, isn't it?
Bottles, all sorts of things.
When you come home from the supermarket,
yeah, you've got
and
loads
you realise that almost everything you've bought is wrapped in plastic. Mm. It's incredible the amount of plastic that we
not to mention
away.
All the equipment that we have. I mean. Is the television made of plastic? Is the vacuum cleaner made of plastic?
Yeah, there's tons of plastic in all of those.
So how on earth do you stop?
Well, yeah, but I mean...
Using all that.
You need to speak to my friend Amber about this because she's kind of on a mission to rid the world of plastic.
So what does she do with her baby feeding bottles, for example? They're all plastic, aren't they?
Well, she breastfed her
does
child.
Does she use disposable nappies?
No,
see?
She didn't use disposable
Good
nappies.
Good for her.
Yeah, it's incredible. Amber is incredible.
Well done. Did she have terry nappies like we used to?
I don't know. I never actually saw all the nappies she used. But, yeah, she didn't use disposable nappies.
Good for her.
Amazing. I can't believe it, really. Mm. And, you know, people, obviously, you did it like that.
We didn't. Terry nappies.
What's terry?
Well, they're like small towels.
Yeah, toweling.
Which we used to, put into a kite shape and attach to you with
safety
pins.
Yeah.
And then put plastic pants over the top.
But, you did have plastic.
Oh, yeah. Otherwise, you'd be soaking wet, you know.
Plastic pants would go over the top, but they're not disposable plastic pants.
No, that's true. We had plastic pants.
But were they disposable plastic pants?
No, they weren't. We used to use them over
and over again.
You reused
them.
And God knows what happened to them when we finished using them.
Was that not incredibly messy and did they not leak and get dirty
sometimes?
And stuff? Yeah.
And you'd have to take the nappies off and you'd have to wash them. You'd have to soak them. You'd have to get rid of all the stuff that was in them. And wash them. But, I mean, that's what you did. You never thought about it because there wasn't anything else.
Right. So what were some of the other questions that they asked you then? No, about plastics.
Oh, about plastics. Oh, media coverage. Have I noticed an increase in
Have you noticed an increase media in media coverage about plastic?
Yeah.
What's the general tone of the media coverage?
Well, it's
in England.
It's
against plastic.
Mm.
What do they say? Because it's usually David Attenborough, isn't it?
It is.
Going, you know, this dolphin is full of plastic.
Yeah.
You know.
In fact, we predict that
within 15 years, all dolphins will be made of plastic. You know,
it's kind of emotional stuff about animals, which is fair enough.
I'm being frivolous and glib about it, it's actually a massive, massive problem that the oceans are all full of plastic and the plastic breaks down. It's been in the ocean for so long that it's now it's breaking down to a sort of micro levels. So that just plastic gets inside the ecosystem at a micro level. So fish are eating it; it's going into the food chain, and then we eat the fish that are full of micro level, you know, that are filled with little bits of plastic, and so it's just plastic everywhere. We're just Not just huge continent-sized, you know, balls of plastic in the ocean, but kind of tiny plastic inside everything all the time.
They also asked if I can, if I could think of examples where packaging had been changed,
yeah,
because of pressure. You know, like chocolate bars, fruit and vegetables, cleaning products and crisps, that kind of thing. And some things have been, you know, like crisps. Lots of people have been putting pressure on crisp manufacturers and telling them to use different packaging.
Okay. Should we move on from plastic now?
Yes, because there's not only so much you can say. There was a lot of questions about recycling and how did we think it worked and all that kind of thing. Yeah. But the other thing was about loneliness and belonging.
Ooh.
Bit more abstract.
Loneliness. We know what
and
that is.
Belonging.
Belonging.
Whether you we feel you belong to your community.
Okay.
And so they asked us about our experiences. Had we ever felt lonely? What was it that caused loneliness? You know, were there certain times of the year when you felt more lonely than others?
Have you ever felt lonely, Mum?
I can't say I have. No.
Really? Mm. Oh, I thought that most people probably. I would guess that most people feel
had a
lonely
period of loneliness
at certain times in their life.
I can't say I ever have, actually.
Oh, okay.
I think I'm lucky, but no, I don't think I ever have felt lonely.
Do you think that people feel lonely more at certain times of the year then?
Well, they say that people feel more lonely at Christmas because that's supposed to be a family time. Mm. I suppose it must be the same. You know, they must see people on holiday and feel lonely. They must, you know, any kind of holiday where families get together, and they must feel lonely. But
have you ever spent Christmas on your own?
No.
I did once when I was in Japan.
In Japan,
time.
Yeah.
I worked on Christmas Day, I think.
Yeah, I remember.
And then that evening, because I finished work quite late, just went home on my own.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah.
But do they celebrate it in Japan? They obviously don't if you to work.
No, they do, but in a different way.
Yeah.
It's not a public holiday.
No.
But people do sort of celebrate it. It's more of a sort of, I think in Japan it's more, so Christmas is something that you do with your girlfriend, boyfriend.
Mm.
You know, it's more like that kind of thing rather than a family occasion.
Yeah.
The family occasion is New Year's Eve, New Year's Day,
yeah,
and Christmas is more of a, something you do with your loved one. You'd have a special dinner or something like that. Probably exchange gifts, but no, it's not. It's not
like here.
Not nearly as sort of important a day as it is over here. So for me, it was kind of like, I can't believe I've got to work on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
So that first of all was very strange.
Yeah.
And then there were loads of people coming to the school. We had this thing called the voice room, which was a conversation room where people could just come in, and there would be a teacher in there. Different teachers would spend an hour in there, so that at any time there'd be someone in there, and the voice room was completely packed all day on Christmas Day, and I spent 1 or 2 hours in there, and basically it was just kind of surrounded by people just sort of quizzing me on Christmas and just kind of, and for me, I just felt like, actually, although, you know, I'm always happy to talk about things like that and share my culture, I felt a sense of
dislocation.
Dislocation, and also just sort of, I felt a bit bitter that I had to work on that day, and that I spent the day describing the things that I would normally be doing on that day. It's like, normally on Christmas Day we don't work, and normally you're at home with your family.
It depends what your job is. I mean, Rick.
If your father Christmas, obviously, it's a different story.
But when Rick was a journalist, he.
You can say his name.
Yeah.
Mum just looked at me like, oh God, did I just give away his name?
Yes, of course. Everybody knows that he's Rick.
The Rick Thompson Report. Anyway,
yes, okay. He used to have to work at Christmas sometimes, and doctors work at Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who work at Christmas.
Yeah, all right.
And I think, in a way, we make far too much of Christmas in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I, as I say, I've never been on my own at Christmas, but...
I can imagine that if you were on your own, that it could be a very, very lonely time.
I mean, for me, it would be a bit of a novelty.
Yeah, for you,
to be on my own.
To be fair, Christmas is a bit of a headache, isn't it? Because you've got to plan and prepare.
I always have loads of people around me.
You've got to cook for them, and it's a nightmare, isn't it? Basically, for you. Plus, also, there's the whole family gets together, and potentially, it can be difficult when families are together, but not all the time. No. Just slightly.
It's always a bit pressured, yeah. Particularly for women.
There's family pressure, yeah, especially for the sort of matriarch of the household.
Yeah, because you have to make sure everything's perfect. You have to make sure the food's perfect. Yeah. Everybody has the right present.
And about that.
It just gets a bit much sometimes.
No, I can totally understand.
So, quite honestly, the idea of being on my own on Christmas Day.
Yeah. Could be refreshing.
Could be.
Go to Japan, Mum. Next Christmas.
Send me off to Japan.
But they'll all just ask you about it.
Yeah.
They'll be like, oh, please tell me about Christmas in your country. Like, no.
But they know they were asking about, are there any times when, because lots of people who do this must have had periods of loneliness. Because, for example, they talk about, when you had to move away from home, for work or university or a relationship.
Right.
The only time I had to move away from home, in inverted commas, is, after I married your father and we moved from Birmingham to London.
You moved out of your parents' house and you moved in with the old man?
No, I wasn't with my parents. I was in my own flat, but I was very close to my parents. Right. So I used to see them every week. And we had to move away down to London, but I have to say, it didn't worry me at all. I was quite happy to do it.
Cool. So loneliness isn't an issue then?
It's never been an issue for me so far.
Good.
I'm glad to say.
Good. Me too. I'm glad to hear that. What about belonging, though?
Yes, belonging as well. I've always felt I belonged wherever I was.
You've always felt you belonged to the community that you lived in?
I've never felt out of place anywhere I've lived, I don't think.
You've never had sort of even something like imposter syndrome. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
What's imposter syndrome?
The only time I had that was when I was doing my Open University degree.
So wait,
and the first time I went, what?
What is imposter syndrome, we have to say?
Well, I was just going to describe
Go ahead, sorry.
The way I see it is when I was first doing my OU degree and I had to go to my first summer school.
So this is a university degree, basically,
but a university degree for older people.
Mature students.
Mature students, and so we study at home on our own most of the time. But we had to go away for a week in the summer to be with other students and behave like ordinary students for a week.
Okay.
And I had that sort of feeling then because I thought, when I go down there, or up there because it was in Manchester, when I go up there to Manchester with all those other students, they're going to see that what's she doing? She's no good. She doesn't know anything.
Say what?
Yeah.
Really? Did you really think that?
I did. I thought that before I went.
Wow.
I thought they're going to find me out. They're going to realise that I'm an imposter and I shouldn't really be on this course. But
it's a university course. I mean, that's the reason.
I know, I thought maybe I wasn't good enough, that everyone else would be much better than me.
No, I can totally appreciate that, Mum, because I think that everyone has imposter syndrome.
That was how I see it, and that's really the only time I've had it, I think.
Okay. Yeah, but okay.
What about you? Have you had it?
Oh, yeah. God, when? Tons of times. I'll tell you what it is. It's actually being an English teacher. That's it. I've just remembered that it's really stupid. But even after 18 years of being a teacher, Delta qualified, award winning podcaster, world renowned English teacher.
Yes, Luke.
Right.
Enough.
I'm not blowing my own trumpet.
No.
I'm setting up the story. Setting up the story.
Mm.
So despite all those things, when it comes to actually day one of a new English course, and I'm about to go into a classroom full of students who've paid their good money to learn English with me, and they've all got their expectations, they all want to master the English language, and often my overwhelming feeling is like, I can't help you. I've been getting away with it for 18 years.
Is often I know how nothing. I
feel. Yeah, I don't know, and I've got to do a damn good job on day one, otherwise they're all going to find me out.
Yeah.
Is Yeah, your mum's now waving a fan in her face.
Does that sound, can you hear that
yes,
on the microphone?
We can hear that on the microphone.
So I can't do it.
Not only am I keeping my mum up, keeping her away from her bed, I'm also making her sit in discomfort with without being able to apply the cooling air of a fan in
which
her face.
Which happens to be
a Japanese,
beautiful Japanese
fan.
Which was not given to me by you.
Ooh.
But James gave it to me when he went to, after he'd been to Japan.
That's right. He came back with this fan. Where did he get that fan? Do you know? Was it from our friends?
Yeah.
Yeah, they gave it to him and he gave it to you. Mm. Right, that's nice.
Yeah.
So I think imposter syndrome, it's something that everyone experiences actually. And I feel like it's quite a good thing for me as a teacher to feel like that, because it makes me prepare myself, it makes me work, it makes me kind of really focus on doing a good job. And it's also, being a stand-up comedian, you feel like that sometimes. When you've got like a big gig and you look at the audience and you see all these people who, again, have paid money or whatever, and they're coming and sitting in, they've asked other people to come out with them, and they're sitting, they've got, you know, they're expecting a good show. And you think, oh my God, I'm the one who's going to have to give them a good night on Saturday night.
Mm.
And you think, oh God, no. And then you kind of go, all right, come on, you've got to do a good show. You've got to do a good show and prepare myself, get in the zone and make sure I go up there and do a good job. And sort of, if I didn't feel, I think if comedians don't feel, after a certain number of years, you do get confident and you know that you've got something. But I think if people don't feel that sense of responsibility and maybe a sense that you're not going to be good enough, that if they didn't feel like that, they'd be lazy and they would kind of be arrogant and stuff like that.
Exactly. I think if you have experienced imposter syndrome, it means that you're not one of these awful, overconfident people.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing that we had to answer questions on in this particular directive was about... It was the 29th of March, 2019. Do you know what's significant about that date?
29th of March, 2019. Yeah. That was when I had my appointment to get my carte de séjour.
Apart from that, in
the Prefecture de Police in Paris.
From that.
It was also the original Brexit day.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
And when they prepared this directive, they were expecting that that would be when we would be leaving the...
So.
EU, so they asked us to do a diary on that day of everything that happened and everything that we felt.
Did you write a diary?
I wrote a diary.
How long did the diary? How long is the entry? Can I ask you
my entry?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know because I haven't got it here.
You haven't got it there. Oh, okay.
Basically, what it said was, "Well, this is just an ordinary day." You know, it was supposed to be Brexit Day, but it's not.
So I had a boiled egg for breakfast.
Exactly. Went to the shops, you know, whatever.
But Mrs. Brown down the road is... oh, God, no, I can't write that. Don't mention Mrs. Brown. Wait a minute. What if we had protests? We've had loneliness and belonging.
Yeah.
Another thing then, please. We're plastics. So this is now the fourth and final directive, the fourth and final subject they asked you about. What's it going to be, folks?
Brexit. What? Oh, sorry.
Not Brexit.
The fourth and final. No, there's two more, actually.
There's two more, okay.
Well, no, there's several because I had the autumn one last year.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've maybe, I've jumped one, haven't I?
Well,
we'll forget
matter.
About the autumn one.
Doesn't matter what the order is, but I'd like to know what the next...
The last one I did, sorry, the first subject was personal identity.
All right.
So what did I identify myself as?
Oh, is this like identity politics? Do you identify as, you know, a certain, you know...
Well, you can tell the sorts of things...
Do you identify as a black woman from the deep south?
Yeah, that was it.
Like that woman, what's her name?
Yeah.
That woman from the United States who's blatantly white.
Yes.
But she identified as a black woman.
But of course, it's because it's local, the things that are going on at the moment... And, of course, gender politics is the big thing,
right.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Like your sexual identity.
Sexual identity.
So, you know, I don't know if you ever use that kind of language, like I identify it as blah, blah, blah.
Well, I did in this. I did in this directive because I had to.
What do you identify as?
I identify as
a white heterosexual woman.
Shush. You had to give five words, I think, and I said I was. I think I said I was female, a wife, a mother.
Yeah.
European.
You said you were. You didn't say you identified as.
Right. No, I say I am identifying as.
Right. Okay.
Female, a wife, a mother, European,
yeah,
a humanist.
I thought you were going to say human there.
And something else. Can't remember.
It obviously wasn't that important.
Female, a wife, a mother.
Yeah.
Something else and humanist.
A humanist.
And European. Humanist and European.
Okay.
Because those are the kind of main things that are my identity, I think. I'm very boring, you know.
Are you?
Yes, because lots of people will identify as all sorts of unusual things, won't they?
Like, yeah.
And they are, you know, they said, are you happy sharing this information? Have you ever had any problem with your, you know, people's reaction to your identity? You know, they're obviously talking about the problems that people have had recently.
Yeah.
Transgender people, hate crimes and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, because I'm sure that some people, I mean, let's say Eddie Izzard, who is
transvestite.
Is it transvestite? Is that the word? I don't know what the correct terminology is, but
I think it is now. He's a male, but he likes to dress as a woman.
He likes to dress in women's clothes. Mm. He describes it as having boy mode and girl mode, and that sometimes he dresses as a guy, and other times he dresses as a girl. But he one of the jokes that he used to do in his stand-up, which nowadays wouldn't be considered to be that funny in the current climate, was that he was a lesbian trapped inside a man's body.
Yes, yeah.
But which basically meant that he fancies girls, but sometimes he kind of wants to be a girl as well, which is interesting. But he he's a comedian, ladies and gents. I've talked about him on the podcast before.
They know who he is,
I suppose. But he's talked about moments where he's experienced hatred and abuse in the streets. And he's even got involved in physical fights in the street with people who've just, for no apparent reason, really, have just decided to pick a fight with him just because he's dressed as a girl. He's chosen to wear makeup that day or something like that. And so, you know, people have started abusing him in the street, and then he's had, you know, physical fights and stuff. So, yeah, the people who read your response were probably very disappointed, Mum.
Probably.
Like, oh, that's no problems there.
Nothing
okay,
here.
No good stories there.
Nothing here for us to use. And the second question was about sex education, which is another contentious issue at the moment.
Right.
It is here. You probably don't know. But it is particularly in a Birmingham school, where where apparently it is procedure for the teachers to teach the children about sex in all its forms,
in all its glory.
So heterosexual sex, homosexual, transgender. You know, all that kind of thing. They're supposed to teach the children, educate the children about all these things. Which
you mean the different forms of sexual intercourse?
Well,
or the different forms of gender identity.
Just everything about gender and sexual identities. They're supposed to educate the kids, so that they know that, you know, everything is acceptable, basically.
Right, yeah, I can see. Because, like, when I was a kid, sex education, I mean, first of all, it was incredibly embarrassing and awkward. I remember watching a video of a French family. I assume they were French because they were naked. a family on the beach playing beach ball. First of all, like, one of the shocking things was actually people playing beach ball. I mean, I've never seen anyone in the real world actually playing beach ball, you know, like with one of those inflatable balls.
Were they really naked?
Throwing it to each other.
You serious?
They were all naked, yeah. So this is like how, oh, look at this is the female for, here's an adult naked man, here's an adult naked woman, and, a young naked child, female, male and stuff. And it's just a family innocently playing with a beach ball on the beach. which is, you know,
that's
fine.
Fair enough.
Yeah, totally fine. Yeah. So, but it was kind of weird. It was sort of, I think it was like there was something weird about the video. It was like kind of, you could tell it was like an imported video,
completely false.
Because well, for
not
us,
not a real situation.
Like, who are these people? Mm. You know, why just put some. Put some gear, put some
Why
shorts
are they
on.
Playing on the beach with no clothes on.
Yeah, it's like fair enough. It's their choice. I think they were French. I think it. I'm not just making that up. I think they were. I think they came from like the same video company that sent us the French education language videos. I think. I don't know. Maybe just in my head, they're all in the same category.
And so, how were these films introduced to you?
Just it was like, okay, you know, this is sex education class, so we're just gonna, you know, learn about sex education, and everyone was like, oh god, and
so they just used to sit you down and play you.
But it would have been a part of a video that included some clips of the family playing on the beach, and then there would have been, you know, some sort of more scientific parts where they, you know, introduced you to the sexual organs, and you looked at the male reproductive organs and the female reproductive organs and stuff like that. And it's like, and here they are on a beach on some people, you know, nowadays, I suppose, what you're talking about is that they would not only have to do that, and it was always about heterosexual sex as well. Mm. So the books that I read in biology and stuff at school, when they dealt with sex, it was always, you know, heterosexual sex and stuff. And the missionary position, of course.
I mean, well, there isn't any other, is there?
Yeah. You were brought up in a convent by nuns, right?
They didn't know what it was. They didn't get any sex education in my school.
Let's not go there.
They were just told, there are some films that you can that are around these days.
What?
That are really dirty and you must never go to see them.
Okay.
That was the only sex education I remember. X-rated films you must never go to.
To be honest, thinking about it, if the biology textbooks had shown us anything other than missionary position, I think it would have been gratuitous, don't you?
Yes.
Like if they'd been doggy style in a textbook, that would have been pretty weird. But anyway,
any road.
But nowadays, yeah, I can imagine it's sort of like very even more complicated because of the sort of the responsibility to teach children about all the different forms and you know, when you accept
the art, you've got to accept people for what they are. You've got to realize that people are different. Not everybody is the same.
Yeah.
That's what you're trying to teach the children or educate them in those ideas.
Yeah.
But there are some parents at these schools who don't approve of it. They think it's
immoral.
And there's been lots of protests, and I mean, it's just very sad. And they ask, in this directive, they ask, you know, what do you think about this and what would you do? And I'm saying, I'm just really glad that I don't have to make any decisions because I have no idea what I would do. I just think that everybody should be educated about everything.
Yeah, it's tough.
If there are certain religious people who don't approve of it, then I don't know what you do, really.
I don't know either, Mum.
Because you've got to respect them for what they believe. If they want their children to grow up not knowing about these things, do you respect them and say, okay, you can take your children out of the lessons?
I don't know. What would Jesus have done?
But anyway, that was one of the questions. And then the last one was about milk.
Oh, thank God for that. Oh, dear. Oh, loneliness and protests and... Sex education. Oh, let's
now
talk about...
Now we're down to milk.
Let's just talk about milk then. Surely this is a safe topic, isn't it?
Well, I think so. It's because they were saying that, you know, there is some indication to show that fewer people are... Or people are drinking less milk, ordinary cow's milk, and that more people are drinking oat milk or almond milk and all this kind of thing because of health concerns and different diets and all the rest of it. So they were asking questions about... You know, do we drink milk? Has our milk consumption changed? And what sort of milk do we drink?
So let's keep this nice and simple then.
Okay.
Tell me about you and milk. Tell me, what's your relationship with milk?
Not very good, really.
Why not?
I don't like it, do I?
What? What's wrong with milk?
I don't like the taste of it.
What's wrong with the taste of it?
It's nasty.
Nasty?
No, it's really weird because I don't like milk. I never have done.
But
I like cream, mm-hmm. and I like yogurt, and I like ice cream.
And you like milk chocolate, I suppose.
Sort of. I prefer dark chocolate.
You put milk in your tea, though, or I should say Dad puts milk in your tea.
I put a little bit of milk in my tea.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only milk I drink, really.
Right.
Because I never have cereal or anything. Yes, because it was interesting. They were saying, has your consumption of milk changed? And I said, the only way my consumption of milk has changed is that since our children left home, we drink far, far less because we don't. We only drink a little bit in our tea and we don't drink much else. We don't have cereal. Whereas when we had teenage children, they lived on nothing but
cereal. When you say we, you mean the household?
I mean me and your dad.
Yeah, but you weren't eating cereal in the mornings, were you, when we were around?
No, but you were.
Yeah, so why are you saying we when, like, you said we, you and Dad,
yeah.
But when James and I were at home eating cereal all the time, you weren't eating cereal too. So your milk consumption hasn't changed.
The household.
Right. Yeah.
The household. That's what milk I just said, consumption. Isn't it? No, you didn't.
Listeners, rewind. I did, didn't I? So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm sorry. I'm wrong.
The household consumption has gone down.
Right, right.
I still think of us as a household.
Right, yeah.
And household has changed because it's just me and your dad now.
James and I used to get through industrial levels of milk. I mean, really. We used to eat so much cereal. It's untrue. Thinking back on the amount of cereal that went through my system.
Incredible.
It's unbelievable, actually.
They would eat cereal in the morning. They'd come home from school. They'd eat two bowls of cereal. They'd have their dinner. Then they'd eat more cereal. I mean, it was just crazy.
You know, when you and Dad would go away on holiday and leave for a week or two,
yeah.
Genuinely, there were times when I was eating cereal for breakfast, lunch and dinner.
Yeah,
I'm not joking.
I know you're not.
And there'd be piles of... I'd use all the bowls in the kitchen and there'd be a pile of bowls all with like sort of like sticky dregs of milk and cereal in every bowl. I'd eat cereal until there were no clean bowls left. And then I'd be like, oh God, what am I going to do? And there are no clean bowls left. I remember I'd stand in the kitchen, leaning on the counter, watching the telly, just scooping the cereal straight into my face.
Yes, I can see that.
Oh, those were the days. I don't know how I could do that.
What do you do with them? How do you stop them behaving in this way?
What, teenagers?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Teenage boys, particularly.
Oh, well, teenage girls are just perfect, aren't they, as well?
Well, I don't know. I haven't had any experience
on
that.
If leaning on the counter watching...
You will soon find out.
I know. Leaning on the counter, eating cereal at home, watching telly, that's the least of your worries, Mum.
Hmm. Still a nightmare. Anyway.
Yeah, so the general consumption of milk in this household
has plummeted dramatically.
Dropped to like trace levels.
So that's what I said. And I also said that we have drunk semi-skimmed milk for as long as I can remember, and we still do.
What's that then? Semi-skimmed?
It means that half the fat is taken away.
Skimmed off the top.
Yeah.
Because the fat floats to the top and they skim it off.
And that we don't drink any other kind. We don't have any truck with this oat milk or almond milk or whatever.
Don't have any truck with it?
Don't have any truck.
What does that mean?
Don't have anything to do with it.
You don't have...
They also asked us about our memories of milk.
Memories of milk.
So I said I remembered in my young
day... The milk diaries.
That... We used to have Milkman, just take no notice of him. He always has to take the mickey.
I think of it as giving the mickey. Actually.
We used to have Milkman coming round, delivering the milk every day. And there was this wonderful sound first thing in the morning of the milk float, the little milk van.
Electric, weren't they?
Electric milk van driving up the road and the clink, clink, clink of the milk bottles. And you could hear the milk bottles going down on the step. And I said how I thought it was a shame, really, that we no longer had that service, because not only was it a service of milk being delivered, but it was a community thing. So the milkman knew everybody, and he knew if people were away, and if he saw loads of milk bottles that hadn't been taken in, He would say, what's happened there? Is somebody ill that they haven't been able to get out and bring in their milk bottles? And he would raise the alarm.
Also, recycling of glass bottles.
I was just coming on to that.
Oh, sorry. Jumps the gun.
And that we used to drink our milk from glass milk bottles, and we would rinse the milk bottles out, leave them on the step, and he would collect them the next day. And it's a shame that we no longer do that, because now all our milk bottles are plastic.
Yeah, going back to the plastic problem.
Exactly.
Again. Yeah, that's right. The milkman knew everyone, didn't he?
Mm.
He knew everyone.
And some, it was just
some people he knew better than others as well. Like they, you know, it's interesting that, isn't it? Everyone in our family is like got dark hair, brown hair, and I as a child was one of the only ones who had blonde hair. And the milkman
had a blonde.
The
milkman
had blonde hair as well. It's interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
Mm. We're joking, of course, listeners. This is a family joke.
It's not just a family joke. It's an old English joke.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, then.
It's a music hall type joke.
Oh, yeah, all right.
Because the milkman used to come round and collect the money every week from the housewives in those days when they used to have housewives.
Yeah.
And, of course, they used to get to know the housewives, and there were always jokes about some housewives knew the milkman better than others, and how the milkman used to go in.
Literally.
To the house.
Right.
And would be in the house for, you know, an hour.
Ooh.
And lots of talk was
okay.
Connected with that. Anyway, yeah, that was the milk thing.
Okay.
And I think
Do you think it's weird that as a culture, that we get through so much milk? Because, you know, going back to Japan or maybe other parts of the world, they don't consume milk to the same degree that we do.
No.
And we must seem like very milky people to them.
Mm.
Like when, let's say, Japanese people come to England and they're just surrounded by English people, we must seem so sort of white and milky and sort of lactosey, don't you think?
Well, weird. I can remember reading something, and I don't know if this is racist.
Oh, careful.
I can remember reading that Japanese people didn't like Western people because we smelled differently because of our milk intake.
They don't like us because we smell.
No, it was because our smell was different.
They probably noticed that we are a bit milky. Mm. Whereas, you know, they might...
They don't have dairy in the same way.
Well,
they don't eat dairy products in the same way.
Not as much. They do eat dairy. Of course, they're eating tons of ice cream and all that stuff, but they don't have as much in their regular daily diet as we do.
Mm.
So, yeah, we must seem very milky to them, which is quite funny in my head. So there you go. I remember that we used to have milk every day at school.
Yeah.
Delivered to us at school.
Yes.
All right. Well, I don't know when that started.
Well, that was started after the war, I think, as a way of building up the youth. Because, you know, during the war we'd had rationing, not much milk, not much protein, not much meat, lots of vegetables, which is probably much more healthy. Anyway, after the war we were given free milk, free orange juice, free cod liver oil.
Oh.
And the milk used to be given to us at school in little third of a pint. I think that's where I started hating milk, because we used to have these crates of little milk bottles waiting for us.
So you'd be at school, right?
Yeah.
And it would be like break time
or
whatever, and you'd be running around the playground.
And they'd say, come and get your milk, and we'd have to queue up and get our milk. We had these little bottles with straws in. Did you have those?
Yeah.
And they'd been waiting outside in the playground in the summer, getting all warm.
The milk bottles just in the sunlight.
Yeah. And so we'd have this horrible warm milk, which tasted absolutely vile.
Ugh.
And that was what really put me off milk, I think.
That's disgusting, actually.
Yeah. And then in the winter, they'd be outside and they'd be frozen.
Like literally frozen.
Yeah.
Freezing.
And the milk used to stand up above the top of the milk.
Yeah, because
it expands when it freezes.
Right, so it'd squeeze out the top. Yeah, I used to remember getting milk at school. There would be these crates, as you said, plastic crates with loads of bottles of I just had a thought. When I was old enough to be drinking milk at school, is this true that was closer to when you were drinking the milk than we are to when I was drinking the milk? Do you know what I mean? So like when I was let's say 10, does this make any sense? When I was 10, that it was in terms of time, that was closer to when you were 10 than we are to now I'm to sure. when I was 10.
I can't
10.
Possibly do the maths, but I know what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, so like, you know, in a sense, like the further away from that period we get, the closer our experiences become.
Absolutely.
So I also remember getting the crates of milk, these plastic crates, and the clink, 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 all the milk would arrive and we'd all be given bottles. And the only thing I remember about it was that each bottle had a little number on the top.
Mm.
They all gave them all numbers.
Mm.
There'd be labels on the top and each one, there'd be a little number on them all. They'd all be numbered. Each batch was, you know, each bottle was individually numbered. And so with our mates, we're all just like trying to work out which number we all had. And like I think the lower number you had, the better you were. So if you got number one or two, you were the best. Whereas if you got, you know, number 36 or something, you were just a total loser.
And this was in Ealing.
This was in Ealing and also in Borsall Common. In Heart of England School.
Really? When you were at secondary school?
Yeah, I remember getting milk there. Yeah.
Good grief.
Yeah. I think they stopped it
after a
year or two.
You know
of
who stopped it?
Maggie Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher, the milk snatcher.
Education secretary.
She took the milk away from the kids.
Mm.
The milk snatcher. Like some sort of pantomime bad guy. Well, Mum, thank you very much for talking to all of us about the mass observation.
Yes.
And these
good
these interesting topics that they've been asking you about. And thank you for being on the podcast. I mean that sincerely.
You're welcome, Luke. I was feeling very tired when I started, but now I've brightened up and full of energy.
It's an invigorating and energizing experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
Podcasting.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're actually doing a little bit of podcasting today because you are an avid podcast listener as well.
I am,
not of my podcast, but
I hardly ever listen to you. Why would I listen to you? I can listen to you any day. I listen to lots of I enjoy podcasts.
That's another story for another time.
It is, yeah.
But thank you, Mum.
You're welcome.
And thank you for everything, including just, you know, absolutely everything you've done for me in my life.
Oh, you're welcome,
and
Luke.
And this contribution you've made to Luke's English Podcast is really the cherry on the top.
Good.
Thank you.
I'm so glad.
All right.
All right, then.
Bye for now, then.
Bye.
So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. I would like to say a big thank you again to my mum for being on the podcast again, and to all members of my family who make a huge contribution every time they're on the podcast. So there you go. So what's up then with you? What's going on with you? It's nearly the end of the summer holidays, isn't it? Well, it is where I am. We're approaching the end of August. So summer is nearly done. That went quickly, didn't it? I hope you've had a good summer or winter, depending on where you are. What have you been doing? Have you been away on holiday, relaxing somewhere? Do you remember in July, I think it was in July, I mentioned a couple of times at the beginning of episodes, I mentioned the LEP meetup that was happening in London. Do you remember that? I talked about how we were having a meetup in a pub in central London and everyone was welcome. Well, the meetup happened. I went to it and I met about 25 to 30 Lepsters, had some drinks and conversation with them for a few hours. And what a pleasant experience that was. It was really, really nice to meet my listeners. And one of the things that I took away from it is that my listeners are lovely, lovely people. Aren't they nice people? I think that's something my brother said to my mum. My mum said to James, like, oh, how was the meetup? And James said, oh, you know what? All the people there were really, really nice. And it's kind of a good reflection on the podcast that the people who listen to it are very nice people. So that's nice. Everything's nice, 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 nice. But anyway, it was good to meet some of my listeners like that. In fact, we recorded some samples of audio during the meetup. In fact, it was Zdenek who did that. He had his audio recorder and he managed to record little samples of audio from almost everyone that came with people talking for a minute or two. And I think I'll be putting an episode together with that stuff. So there will be an episode about the LEP meetup with some bits of audio samples and stuff that you can listen to. all to encourage you to do the same thing. I'll talk about that on the podcast soon. In terms of other upcoming stuff, well, it's the usual things that you've come to expect from Luke's English Podcast. I'm not going to mess with the formula too much. There'll be conversations with guests, and I've got a few guests in mind that I'd like to have on the podcast soon, as well as returning favourites. I mean, for example, Paul Taylor, he's currently looking after his baby daughter. His daughter was born, and so he's currently sort of dealing with nappies and sleepless nights and things like that. But when I get the chance, I'll get him on the podcast as well with Amber. And lots of other people that have never been on this podcast before. I've got plans to talk to a few different people coming up in the next few months or so. Also, just the usual stuff about the usual bits of UK culture and things like that. I've got some things lined up about British comedy and all kinds of other stuff. There's just no end to the stuff I can talk about on this podcast. So that's nice, isn't it? So you can look forward to more of the usual stuff coming up. Also, episodes of premium stuff coming soon. If you're a premium subscriber, you'll see that I recently published Premium Series 15. That's four episodes. Covering topics relating to science and medicine and stuff like that. So four episodes, one episode which is full of like discussion and reading an article and just the topic, basically just talking about the topic. And then two episodes focusing on the language, the vocab, giving lots of examples, explaining, pointing certain things out, little details that you need to know about the vocab, like collocations and suffixes and prefixes and things, and then an episode with a test and pronunciation drills. So that's the latest premium series that I just published this month. If you'd like to sign up to LEP Premium, just go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium, and there you can sign up. And basically for the price of about a coffee every month, you can get access to all of the premium content. And there's over 50 individual episodes now. I mean, they're you know, spread out into different parts, but 50 parts, at least 50 parts across 15 episode series and a few one-off things and a few videos and things as well. So the premium library is growing all the time, and you can listen to the premium content using the app or online. All the details you can find at teacherluke.co.uk/premium, basically. Okay, so that's it then for this episode. Thank you so much for being a wonderful listener, and for generally being a lovely human being and an excellent person all round. And I look forward to reading comments in the comments section on the website, and also any emails that you send to me through the website or through the app. That would be very nice. Okay, so I'll let you just go back to your normal life now. Thank you for listening to my podcast, and I'll speak to you again soon. But for now, it's time to say goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.